Let me explain a little bit about the title, because the thing that I want mostly is, you know, is discussion. I've got enough material to go for, you know, forever. But this is a series. There are going to be four, and then tomorrow night we'll be on the forum, and that'll be the fifth one, and that's going to be on the year, you know, the year 2000, something else. And basically what I'm doing is taking the idea, do we have to reinvent the faith in light of the, you know, very important, significant changes, you know, that are taking place, you know, in so many parts of our life now. There are all sorts of things taking place, and where do we hold fast and where do we go ahead? There's, in fact, the title of the book I wrote was called Holding Fast, Pressing On. Hold fast to that which is true, you know, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever, but what does that mean in light of so many things, you know, that are taking place? Today we'll be on some of the new research and some of the new insights about what we call the historical Jesus. I think we'll talk about the Jesus Seminar, and we'll talk about another one that's close to the Jesus Seminar. It's called Q or Quell, which is the German word for source, and we'll talk about those scholars and what they have to say, and then have some response to that. And then tomorrow, I forget what time, but I think it's 6:30, tomorrow we'll be talking about what I call globalizing Christianity. And what difference does it make, you know, that we know so much more about other world religions? And how should we respond to other religions in the world? Very important subject, and then we'll do on the forum tomorrow night on 2000, what's going to happen. And then I think it's on Thursday, I'll be talking about whatever happened to heaven and hell. That became a very lively subject for a while, and it's different. What they're teaching now is different than what I grew up with on this, and we want to talk about that and have your discussions. And then the last one will be what I call it's reinventing the faith. And then has individualism replaced, you know, our community? In other words, are we so much more self-centered that we've lost a good deal of what we used to share and get along with other people? And that has to do with church life, and that has to do with a lot of other things. There was a famous essay written 2 years ago by a fellow at Harvard named Robert Putnam, and he calls it soul bowling. And what they have is very good proof that there are actually more people bowling, but there are fewer people bowling in leagues. You know, the idea used to be that the main reason you bowled was for sociality, you know, for socializing and getting along and having fun with people and, you know, everything else. And now, just as preview of coming attractions here, it looks like for whatever kinds of reasons, people are more interested in doing things themselves. You know, membership and things like Boy Scout, their leadership is down, Red Cross, League of Women Voters, all sorts of things is down, and that's an interesting subject, and we'll be dealing with that on Friday. If some of you are still here, you know, I haven't used up all my jokes yet by that time. We'll get ahead with it. So I welcome your discussion, and this is the, I think I've said to some of you, this, maybe I shouldn't put this on tape, but that's all right. This is the first time I've ever talked the subject, and I say that because sometimes you are the more alert and more fresh and aware when you do it the first time. I have one lecture I've given maybe about 35, 40 times, and I could give that one obviously a blindfold. It's a fun one, but I'm not all that alert any longer on it. But I think on the first time through, I think this is interesting. And also, I'm field testing the ideas. I want your comment, and where you think I'm wrong, or where you think it isn't clear, or something that you want to say, by all means, you know, tell me. I'm a big boy now, I can handle criticism, I'm not worried about it. I've survived 38 years of college teaching, plus graduate school where they give you the Dickens all the time, and I learned that, I can cope with this, and I don't take it personally unless you don't like my shirt or my haircut or something else like that. My jokes do, I hope you don't say that about my jokes, because I have a good saying, and people around here know it, that I like, and I think it's very important that, you know, we can laugh. There's a wonderful proverb in the book of Proverbs, Proverbs 17:22. What is it? A merry heart is good medicine, but a downcast spirit dries up the bones. And that's good Jewish humor. And I think it's good. A merry heart is good medicine, but a downcast spirit dries up the bones. And so we'll laugh, you know, from time to time. It's very, I think, very important. The founder here, Carol Henderly, was a great one for that. If some of you might know, and if you look tonight, and that above the stage, you'll see it says, God gives us the seasons for gladness of heart. And I remember when they put that one up, I was here then. And he liked to laugh too. Okay, so if we stop every so often for a laugh. Come in, this is the one on the historical Jesus, and the resources are next door. The resources selection is next door. All my is comment, question, raise questions on this, because what I'm going to do is take these, and it's very important that I do it right here, and then in the wintertime, now I'm retired, my wife and I are snowbirds in Scottsdale, Arizona, and I speak to all kinds of different Lutheran churches down there, and I'm going to present this series of lectures down in Scottsdale also. So by the time we've been through all these, who knows, they might even lead to a book. That might be fun. And usually a book comes out of things that you've tried out. And I must say with my one other procedural thing here, I'm not a walleye pike fisherman. They are trollers and you just go out and sit there and hold it. I'm a bass fisherman where you keep casting until you get some action. If something doesn't work, you bring it back and you do it over again, right? And or fly fishing too, if you like that. And that wonderful movie, A River Runs Through It, if you know, that's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful movie. Oh, anyway, and my daughter is a fly fisher woman, I suppose you could say. And I envy her, she's in Vermont, and she can go fly fishing in Vermont, and all the leaves are turned and everything else. And she was here for a year. She enjoyed it very, very much. Okay, anyway, enough rambling here. It takes me about 5 minutes. I'm like Baptist black preachers. It takes me about 5-10 minutes to warm up. And I haven't talked for quite a while, so I guess I'm warmed up at this point. Now, I raised this question about the historical Jesus and reinventing the faith, and the point I want to make is, you know, what difference does this information that I'm going to present, what difference does it make for our faith? Where do we, you know, hold fast, you know, as I say, to that which is true, or where do we press on? Where do we make changes? Obviously, in the church, we made changes. Martin Luther was somebody who made a few changes, you know, along the way, and from that point on, really, we've been open to some sort of changes, but we don't want to make changes, you know, simply for its own sake. Because sometimes you can do that, and you just go, you get caught up in the latest fad, and the latest craze, and so on. But there are times where we have to hold fast, and this is where I want to ask. And there's some very interesting stuff that comes up on this, and I started this series, these four or five presentations, with the one on the historical Jesus, because, you know, with Christianity, we either rise or fall, we either stand or fall with Jesus. When you say, you know, you want to do the Christian thing, that means obviously we have to center everything around, you know, the person of Jesus. Okay. And that means we have to look at this with great care, because I'll be saying this later on too. The interesting thing here from the standpoint of, you know, research and background, we know in terms of history, in terms of historical evidence, not in terms of what we'll call biblical witness, I'll talk about that later, but in terms of historical evidence, that which we know for sure, we know more about Caesar Augustus than we know more about Jesus. That's an amazing sort of thing. We know more about, say, Caesar Augustus than we know about Jesus. And I want to talk about that in some detail because that makes all kinds of differences to what we're doing. And we know more about people like Muhammad, for instance, than we do. We know more about Lord Buddha than we know about Jesus. And that raises, you know, some questions. What's so important about this? Okay. Now, I raise this one because maybe you remember around Easter this last year, the big three news magazines, Time, Newsweek, and U.S. News and World Report, all had long and really, I think it's fair to say, really pretty good articles on what we call the historical Jesus. Usually it's interesting that the weekly magazines, they decide to have a religious issue, you know, once a year. They figure Easter is the time they can do it for Christians, so we have a little bit extra on that. But Time, Newsweek, and New U.S. News and World Report all had stories about the historical Jesus. You go to the bookstore up here, you'll find a lot of books on this subject we call the historical Jesus. Okay, I think that's important. And here it raises a question that I want to sort of rephrase using the words of a history teacher, or a Bible teacher actually, at Yale Divinity School by the name of Reverend Childs. I didn't put the name on the board. But Reverend Childs is a real expert in this area, and he said this: for the average devout Christian, whose life is shaped in some measure by the preaching and liturgy of the church, there is a sense of great uncertainty. Has the church's confidence in the scripture, as the enduring word of God, been sorely mistaken? Some people are saying that. I'm saying that now more really than ever before. If the Bible is just another cultural artifact, just one more interesting book, like the Iliad or the Odyssey from Homer or some other Greek literature or Plato or Aristotle or something like that, if the Bible is just another cultural artifact that is conditioned by its historical context and vulnerable to endless alterations of meaning through reinterpretation, the big word here is contextualization. In other words, I put this on the board, meaning is that you can't understand the Bible unless you know and interpret it only on the basis of its setting, of its time. That it was written for that time to those people, and it has no particular meaning beyond that. I found it fascinating. I didn't realize just one small thing. When the Bible says walk the second mile, you know what that means? What
is the Greek or the Roman requirement to carry the load of a soldier for a mile? And they said then you could put it down and someone else could pick it up.
Right. And if you didn't know that, if you didn't know the context of that, you would miss that point. All right. And it was sort of a form of minor punishment, wasn't it? If you did something and they made you carry your big pack, you see these people around here carrying their 35-pound packs now, and so on. Yeah. But that's what I mean by contextualization. If you didn't know that, you wouldn't know what it means by walk the second mile. And so on. Okay. If we only use it in context, how can it serve as the authoritative word of God? Okay. How can one speak of Jesus as the same yesterday, today, and forever if the figure of Christ is really only an empty symbol without a fixed profile and merely a convenient construction to buttress, you know, group identity? Some big words there, but I think that's the point I want to make. There has always been doubt about Jesus. In fact, Jesus himself has that famous statement, who do you say that I am? What we call the Christological question in the seminary teachings there are all called, you know, Christology. People at that time. And the record, you know, if you read it, the record isn't 100% clear. That has to be said. And I'll talk a little bit later on how the first three Gospels differ rather significantly from the Gospel of John on this. Okay. Now, what has happened with all the changes and all this has taken place is something which I think Charles summarizes very well. And I want to give an illustration of this. He said, really up until about the 18th century, about maybe the 1850s, 1860s, the Bible interpreted the world. That is, up until that time, the Bible interpreted the world. When we want to know about science, when we want to know about anything at all like this, we would go to the Bible. When we want to know about disease, you know, what it is, we went to the Bible, and the Bible explained the world to us. Now, since about the last 100, 200 years, what happens is that the world explains or interprets the Bible for us. We use worldly or scholarly standards to interpret what the Bible means. Let me give you one example from my teaching. Coming back with a name like Aaron Yorsta, you'd think, and coming from St. Olaf, I would be a big fan of our famous novelist, probably our most famous teacher of St. Olaf, and that, of course, would be Ole Rovvalder, with Giants in the Earth. The great novel about the Norwegian pioneers out in South Dakota. Okay. If you know the book, you'll remember this scene, and otherwise I'll explain it here. In a very famous passage, the farmers had planted their crop and the grasshoppers came forth. Okay. And what the farmers had to try to do was try to explain why this should happen. They didn't know very much about science or about entomology. Is that the study of bugs? I think it is, something else like that. Okay. They didn't know anything about this. They didn't know anything about drought. They didn't know all the rest of these things. But they used the Bible to explain the drought. It was a plague. They were being cursed. They were being punished. And they understood that the Bible explained this, interpreted it to them. Or when they were suffering or pain or death or something else like that, they explained it in terms of the Bible. Now we turned around and the world explains what the Bible is. We use standards of historians or of linguists or students of language or whatever else and say that the Bible has to come up to these standards, and otherwise, you know, it's somewhat shaky or dubious. And if we don't explain it on the basis of the standards of the world, then we have some reason to doubt it. Okay, is that, I want to be sure, you know, this is where I don't want to go ahead. What is it Dan Rather has in his program, a reality check? Every so often, you want to know what's going on. Okay. Now, to get at this, I want to be sure that's so important. That we used to use the Bible to explain the world. Now the world explains the Bible. If the Bible has something that, quote, isn't scientific, then there must be something wrong, you know, with the Bible. That's what I'm trying to say. and how they've argued that about evolution and creationism and all those things. Okay, now, I want to raise give you a couple of questions here for discussion to think about as we go through this material, and then we can come back to these at the end of the period. Okay. First of all, I have one that's related here. You know, what do you find, how do I put this? What do you find about the personality of Jesus that holds your attention? Why, you know, this? Because we did text study here Saturday morning. We always have, on Saturday morning with the pastor, the one who's going to preach, we read over the text. And I do this down in Scottsdale, too. On Tuesday mornings, the pastors in our conference, it's called the Northeast Conference, and we're in the Grand Canyon Synod, meet every Tuesday. And then we look at the text. One person always has the leadership. And then there are about 10 to 15 pastors and others who come. And then we go over the text and share ideas and, you know, look at the text, see what's going on. Okay. And one question that always, you know, comes up that I find so fascinating, and that is, what is there, you know, in the personality of Jesus that is so, you know, so fascinating? Always there's something new, something different that comes up. Sometimes it strikes me, and this is what I was going to say for Hale on two Saturday. Susan was, if you heard her preach last night, Susan was leading the discussion, the text study on Saturday, and it came to me, we were reading that one about the Syrophoenician woman, that Jesus sometimes is really weird. I mean, that's the one where this is some strange guy that, you know, he isn't the Jesus sitting, remember the picture in the Sunday schools and the white robe and the little children around him and the butterflies and the flowers and the sunshine, and he looks sort of Swedish, you know, as Garrison Keillor would say, we sort of made him into, you know, to somebody like us. And I'll say something a little bit later about what Jesus, we think Jesus really looked like, but he really is sort of a strange guy. You know, let the dead bury the dead, and, you know, some what they call the hard sayings of Jesus. There's some really tough stuff in there that you can't sort of, you know, put under the rug, or something else like that. Okay, what is there about the personality or about Jesus that holds our attention on this? Okay, another one, why do you think questions like the ones that we're going to be dealing with now, why do they keep coming up? Why can't we sort of find answers and subtleties once and for all? Why can't we sort of say, here is what the record is, and here are the facts, and boom, 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 we go down the line, and that should take care of it. What is it, that bumper sticker that the fundamentalists use? The Bible said it, I believe it, that settles it. Yeah, there we go, that's the one. We don't find that, that doesn't... You don't find that on Lutheran Bible state. No, that's not on the Lutheran one. The Bible said it, I believe it, and...
Let's discuss it.
I'm sorry?
Then let's discuss it.
That's good. Yeah, right. Maybe somewhat, but I don't find that many, you know, fundamentalists among the Lutherans. Okay, now, so far okay? I want to come back to these questions and see where we go with these things. The first one that's getting most attention of the scholarly groups here that's been looking at this is called the Jesus Seminar. Okay, that's the one that gets all attention, and they have a very good PR guy named Robert Funk, who is the sort of the promoter for it, and it's always getting a lot of attention, and he likes getting attention. He doesn't want it to be just a group of academics sitting around and writing articles about each other and criticizing each other, but he wants to get it out on the road. Okay. It was organized in 1985 by Robert Funk, who is an internationally famous Bible scholar. Okay, no question about that. The members, and they include people from all the major churches, including some Lutheran churches. There's a good friend of mine up at Concordia College in Moorhead named Arlen Jacobson. I don't know if any of you happen to know Arlen is in on it. Okay, but he's there. They meet twice a year, and here, for the sake of voting, this sounds, you know, strange the first time you hear it, but anyway, for the sake of voting on the historical accuracy of the sayings of Jesus, did Jesus really say these things? I mean, people, whether Jesus never wrote anything, of course, at all, wrote once in the sand, wasn't it? I think that's all, the only time Jesus ever wrote anything, but obviously he was very literate, he knew the Old Testament, you know, code and everything. But we think, obviously, that the four gospel writers were the ones who wrote the things down. Okay. Did Jesus say the things that are attributed to him, or did some people later on say, write down what they remember or what they think Jesus should have said? That's the big point. I want to stay, we sure are on that one. We sure are being on that point. I'll give some illustrations that did Jesus say these things when they wrote them down, like the Sermon on the Mount, or whatever it might be, some of the famous teachings, or did people who came later and knew Jesus later, what we call the post-Easter Jesus, because that's going to make a big difference in our story here, the difference of the resurrection and everything. Did they write things down that therefore they are second-hand rather than first-hand, you know, sources of information, and therefore maybe aren't quite as reliable? You see, that's the big test. There's going to be an answer to this, and but I want to go through this because I want to be sure that point is clear. That's so important. Now, what they do is they have a system of voting which gives each of the scholars there four different little balls with different colors. And the if they take up a saying of Jesus that's attributed to him, if you send in the red ball, that means you're sure Jesus said it. If you send in the pink ball, that means maybe he said it, you're not quite so sure. If you send in the gray ball, that means most likely he didn't say it. And if you put in a black ball, I don't know why they use black ball, but they did anyway. Black is always connected with negativism, I guess, and everything else on it. Then for sure, you know, you know that Jesus really didn't say it. Okay. So you've got the Jesus people voting on the seminar, voting on all these different things. Now, theirs is not a very easy kind of task at all. And I want to come back to the point that I made before. Theirs is not a very easy task because of the limited amount, the very limited amount of actual historical information that we have about Jesus. So I say we know more about Caesar Augustus than we know about Jesus. The most interesting book that I found, and there's all kinds of books on this, it's a new one that just came out, Frank Shorto, it's called, Gospel Truth. And I'm going to draw some points here from Shorto's book, Gospel Truth. What he says, he spent, you know, a long time doing research on this. And he says there are five things that we know about Jesus for sure. Five things for sure. He's not in any history books. You know, there was only one sort of ancient historian named Josephus who wrote down two things about Jesus when he was writing about the Roman Empire and all the rest of these things. But there are five things we know for sure. Most likely, yes, there was a historical Jesus. No question about that. There was a Jesus of Nazareth. He lived. He created quite a stir locally with his teachings and his healings. We know that. And he was killed by the Romans, almost certainly by crucifixion. That is one thing for sure. Okay. Secondly, some people are interested, what did he look like? He didn't look like a Swedish Lutheran, as I've suggested, or anything else like that. But he looked most likely, we think he was, if anything, with his background, he would be Palestinian. Palestinian seems to be the closest. There was a uniform racial pattern type in Palestine. And his disciple, he and his disciples were from Palestine, from Galilee specifically, and Shorto says it was their skin color, it was not their skin color, but it was their speech that set them off from others. Because it's like we would have with a southern accent or a western accent or an accent from Maine or something else like that. And the Galileans were considered what we would call hillbillies by the very sophisticated, you know, worldly-wise, you know, Jerusalemites. Okay. But we do have a pretty good idea of what he looked like. When was he born? Most likely about the year 4 BC. In what we call the Common Era. I didn't realize this, how much that phrase has sort of taken over. Yeah. We used to call it BC and AD, before Christ and Anno Domini, in the year of Christ or the years after Christ. But the BC has taken over now because that simply means, the Common Era has taken over. That means the age we used to call AD, because it's used also by people who aren't Christians. For a long time we used AD simply because Anno Domini means, you know, obviously in the year of our Lord. And now it's called Common Era. I think what it is, it's sort of a concession to what we call being politically correct. We don't want to offend Islamic or Buddhist people or something else like that. So I go with the flow. I mean, there are some things that you can change and some things that you can't change. What's that wonderful serenity prayer of Reinhold Niebuhr? Lord, give me the courage to dare to do the things that must be changed. Patience to accept the things that can't be changed, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Thank you.
I had Reinhold Niebuhr as a teacher for 2 classes. I can tell you some stories about that later on. I'm supposed to do this one now for the tape. Okay. When was he born? Probably about the year 4 BC. Because Matthew and Luke both say that he was born near the end of the reign of Herod, our old friend Herod. And we know for sure that Herod died in the year, what we would call now 4 BC. With this, okay. We adopted the birthday date of Mithras. He was a Persian god for when Jesus was born. They really don't know. They think it was about 4 BC. But we adopted the birthday date of a Persian god, as that once Jesus became popular, they had to sort of, they had to, you know, emphasize the idea that Jesus really was on earth, and that there really was a, you know, an incarnation here, and so he was born of Mary, therefore he had to have a birth date, and so the best thing they could do was come up with this one. And we know for sure, you know, I don't want to spoil anything here, but we know for sure it wasn't, you know, December 25th. When Jesus was born, but that's when they said there's some connection there with the winter solstice and some other things like that. And of course, there's some Christian religions that don't celebrate Christmas at all because it was identified with a pagan cult celebrating the winter equinox. One thing I kind of miss up here, when Carol was the director here, we would celebrate Christmas on July 25th. You know, if Christmas is fun once a year, why shouldn't Christmas be fun twice a year? They'd even have lutefisk, that was too much, but that was asking too much. But that's gone, and now they have a Jubilee Day, is what they have here on July 25th. And good Old Testament Day, if you know the Jubilee and from Old Testament times. We have a big time here already. Anyway, but we know that he was born about 4 BC. And now this is going to be important because you'll hear me say tomorrow night when we're talking about you know, what's going to happen with the year 2000. And you know, some people think, boy, when that ball comes down, you know, over the New York or over the Times Square, you know, in New York, everything else, that's going to be it. Maybe we're there already. That's what I'm trying to say, and nothing has happened. This may well be the year 2000 right now. You know, I'm going to use the joke tomorrow, and I'll try it out on you and see if it's worth doing tomorrow night. But anyway, what Ruth, my wife, and I have sort of decided is what we're going to do to celebrate the year 2000 when it comes in. We're going to have a very nice dinner party, the best one we've ever given. You know, 3 wines and 7 courses. We're going to do the whole thing. And we're going to have a good time. And we're going to sit and watch the ball come down, you know, like this. And then we're going to go to bed. And we're not going to do the dishes. We're not going to do the dishes. If we're lucky, there'll be some big RCA Whirlpool dishwasher up there who's going to take care of our dishes for us. Some of you are laughing, some of you aren't, so maybe I'll tell them. But some strange stuff. Where was he born? Most likely it was Nazareth and not in Bethlehem. And here we see some stuff about what we call the canon in the church. Because, you see, Luke and Matthew were driven really by a desire to present Jesus as a fulfillment of an Old Testament prophecy. An Old Testament prophecy. And the Old Testament prophecy was that the Messiah should come from the city of David. You know, all the Christmas carols are going off in your head now. The city of David, who we call Bethlehem. And that, therefore, they put down that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, although we think it was Nazareth. Although it's one of the strange things, maybe some of you have been in the Holy Land, Nazareth has just sort of disappeared. He really never sort of got anywhere. All right, but most likely he was born in Nazareth. All right. Was he a carpenter before he began preaching? That's interesting. Was he a carpenter? Because suddenly, you know, carpenter, and then he becomes the Messiah. Strange stuff. Okay. Now, the idea that Jesus was a carpenter depends on one short reference in Mark. Is this not the carpenter or the son of Mary? Now, I put the word on the board here. The word is T-I-K-T-O-N. And that's not necessarily carpenter. Is this not the carpenter or tikton? Which also could be laborer or stonemason or woodworker. But we don't really know much else. Clearly, this is a reference to these things. But I remember, I mentioned this because I've heard people say that Jesus was really, after all, a capitalist. Because he had this woodworking shop down there in Bethlehem or in Nazareth, and he was doing pretty well with it. You know, just like he had started off his own business and he had, you know, Jesus woodworker or something, you know, with a, and probably advertised it. You know, everybody trying to make Jesus into what they want him to be, that's what I'm trying to say. He probably voted, you know, Republican, you know, all these other things. Okay. Now, back to the seminar. Now, with this is with this in mind. Now, what they have said in all these things is that only 18% of the sayings which we have always associated with Jesus, only 18% of these sayings really can be confidently traced to him. That's a very small proportion. Only 18% can be traced to them. Okay. Because what they are saying, and this is the point here, is that we can be sure of some things of Jesus, but we can't be sure, you know, of all of them. And that therefore, in light of the fact that some of his followers may have said some things that they want the world to know, you know, through the Bible, that Jesus said themselves, that there were actually things that they said. All right. The big problem here becomes the difference between what we call the Synoptic Gospels and the Gospel of John. The first three Gospels are what we call the Synoptics, and the Gospel of John is a whole different ballgame, you know, altogether. Totally different game altogether. It is very different from the Synoptic Gospel. And everybody acknowledges this. No question about this. I've got a long statement here, but I've been running behind because of some bad jokes I've been telling anyway. But I've got, we'll go through this. In John, Jesus speaks as a divine person. You don't find this in the Synoptics. In John, you have probably the most famous, you know, of these things is what they call the I Am statements. I am the true vine, I am the good shepherd, you know, I am the way, the truth, and the light, all these things. Jesus speaks from the very beginning as though he is the Messiah. You don't find that in the first three Gospels. And people, you know, want to know why. If all these stories are stories about Jesus and they're historically true, why shouldn't there be a uniform picture of Jesus through all four Gospels? That's the lead, okay? That's a question. And some people say, since there is, this is the conclusion that they draw, since there isn't a uniform picture of Jesus through all four Gospels, therefore we have to be a little bit suspicious. My own personal reaction to that is, what I like is that this allows for the unique personality of each of the four Gospel writers. That they weren't stenographers sitting there taking dictation and writing things down. That always has been a question for a long time. There were some of the early biblical scholars who thought that the writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, were all sort of like stenographers, and God was whispering in their ear, and that they were sitting there, you know, writing all this down. And that obviously isn't the case, because you have to allow for the differences in each of these ideas. Okay. So, what I'm getting at here is that the Jesus seminar people have caught on because there are those in our day, and our day is a day really of doubt, and of skepticism, and of cynicism, and things like that, who said that maybe this Jesus seminar business is really onto something. And of course, the Jesus seminar people know how to promote themselves. They promote themselves as being the voice, really, of reliable and progressive and up-to-date research. Nobody wants to be, you know, in my field, I do a lot of research, nobody wants to be old and stuck in the mud or something else like this. So these people promote themselves as being, you know, the up-to-date ones. And anybody who would oppose, this is the idea too, and it's just the opposite, anybody who would oppose the Jesus seminar must either be, you know, reactionary fundies or fundamentalists, I should say, who are afraid of the findings, or sort of wet blankets, or what we would call sour grapes, or jealous, really, of the popularity of the Jesus seminar. Okay. So that, I just want to be sure that that one is the one that's getting most of the attention, the Jesus seminar. And as I say, when it gets on the front cover of Time, Life, and Newsweek, not Life, Time, Newsweek, and U.S. News, it's important. All right. Now, what can be said here is something that I have to go into a little detail on. And that is that the Jesus seminar people don't accept, and this is, you know, a long, complicated subject, but I'll do my best to answer. They don't accept what we call the canon of the New Testament, the C-A-N-O-N, not the canon, the other thing, but the canon, the norm of the New Testament. All right. And this is a really tricky one here, because as we know in here, I've got the next one too. I've got the Jesus seminar Bible here, and I've got about 10 more here. There's all the secret Gospel of Mark and translations from 12 other Gospels. There were lots and lots of books floating around at that time, or manuscripts floating around at that time about Jesus and about all sorts of things. Thomas, the Book of Thomas, and all sorts of things. And so the early church had to decide which books are we going to use. Which books are we going to say, these are the right ones, and those we aren't going to use. And it's so fascinating to me, one of the most interesting ones is the book of Revelation almost didn't make it by Big Bang being used. And sometimes I kind of wish, you know, how do I say it? I wish it hadn't been used, because it was strange plates and things flying around. And when we're coming to the year 2000, that book's going to be, you know, big time. All right, anyway, the canon, all right. Now the question of the canon, so they had to decide which books we're going to use. They had to, they were going to say, you know, Christianity is different from Judaism, and here's why it's different, and here are the materials that we have. Jesus died about 29 BC, we think, or AD, or year, we call it common year, and something like that. And so therefore, we can't go back and ask Jesus, you know, what he was right anymore. So we have to rely on various kinds of books and manuscripts. Which ones do we use? The question of the canon differs from questions of the authenticity or inspiration or value of the several New Testament books. Primarily, the question was to what books were read in the Church of Public Worship. Those so used became, in the course of time, the Christian scriptures. Then, having the value of scripture associated with them, they came to be treated as authoritative. We don't really know, this is a fascinating thing, we don't really know at that time why some books were chosen and others weren't. That's an astounding sort of thing, but that's the way it is. Okay, this is from the best Bible encyclopedia I can find. The growth and recognition of the canon of the New Testament is one of the most important developments in the thought and practice of the church. Absolutely, no question. Which books do we use, which books don't we use? Because we found this, you know, Gospel of Thomas and there's some, or, you know, if you're Catholic, you use the Apocrypha, the 14 books, you know, in between on these things. Okay. Yet history is absolutely silent as to how, when, and by whom the canon was brought about. That is, you know, absolutely silent. No matter how much research we have, we don't know. These books have simply been given to us and received by us, and there they are. And the battle, these people are saying, maybe we should re-examine some of these things again. And they think we can do it. And that leads to the second point that I want to get at on this point. There's another group besides this, the Jesus group, the Jesus Seminar group, who are doing research on this. And this is a group sometimes known as the Q group, or the Quelle group, which is the German word for source. And they are doing some other things that are slightly more, I think, responsible than what some of the what the Jesus people group are doing. All right. And there's a fascinating piece here, if you want to read it, I think it's in the library here too, back home. If you can get a copy of the Atlantic Monthly, it's a good, you know, solid magazine. The Atlantic Monthly for, isn't it December? Right. December of 1966. The Search for a No-Frills Jesus. And they have a very good, understandable piece on this group called the Q Group. Sometimes academics, and I lived with academics for 38 years, like to play with big words and get lost in verbiage and things like that. This is a very good piece on what the Q Group is doing, and it's written in language that, you know, any serious or any person who's interested in this subject would find interesting. Okay, and we'll see what happens with that. Okay, now the Q Group on this. Some 35 scholars have worked for about 15 years, right, assembling passages from Matthew and Luke, and comparing and contrasting these passages. And we have what they call the Q document here, and I've got this, and I can leave this here after I finish it once more. I can leave it over here in the library on this. They're comparing and contrasting writings from Luke and Matthew, and have accumulated all sorts of information on what other historians and scholars over the centuries have said about these things. That's one of the wonderful things about computers. You can get all this information, you know, online, and you can have it there instantly available. You don't have to go to the big dark or the big black books or something. You know, it's like my son, who's an attorney. He wants an opinion by the Supreme Court from back in 1832. He hits, you know, a button, and boom, it's right there, and you can. They say download it. I still say print off. I don't want to start on that one. But it took me 6 weeks to learn how I even. This is the power switch. It's about as far as I got in my first 6 weeks with mine, but I finally learned it. And anyway, they have all sorts of information, you know, at their disposal. All the research and the writings that have been done over a very long period of time. And they are important because they've come up with a different thing than the 18% that the Jesus Seminar people had. They came up with the idea that there were these different sayings, you know, between Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, these different statements and teachings and stories about the healings and all the rest of, like the healings we had in the sermon last night and all these things. And they, you know, they asked the question, you know, why? And their idea is this. Matthew, and this is the big one, Matthew and Luke drew from another book which is no longer present, but which was a collection of the sayings and the writings and the impressions by people who saw Jesus firsthand. See, always the attempt is to get firsthand information. Because maybe you play that game where you have about 20 people in a circle and somebody whispers something and then it goes around and then you, you know, the telephone, is that what it's called? Right, okay, sure. And you know what it's like at the end of these things, okay. Just there. And sometimes trained scholars, you know, can't do this very well. And so, all right, you get the idea. So they're looking for first-hand information. And what they've come up with is that there was a collection of writings available to Matthew and Luke. This is, they call it the Q document, or the Quellus document, or the source document. There were those at the time of Jesus who sat down and wrote on, I suppose it'd be papyrus, they didn't have, you know, paper as we understand it, these things, and there was actually a physical document that was available for them. Okay, that's a very important point. This document has been lost. Some people say if it's lost, maybe it never existed. Maybe there was something that has been made up. But their argument is this, I'm going to try to put it as strong as possible right here. Their argument is this, that Matthew and Luke could not have come up with what they said unless they drew from another common source ahead of time. There had to have been another source closer to what Jesus actually said than what they had themselves. So it couldn't have happened any other way. Okay, that's I could go into great detail on that. I have to give an example there. I remember when I was doing my dissertation, I could prove, I had about six facts, okay? And I could prove the first four, but I couldn't prove the fifth fact, but I knew how the story came out with the sixth fact. So since I couldn't prove fact number five, I said it had to have happened this way. Otherwise, we couldn't have gotten the result that we did with number six. My advisor didn't buy that at all. He said, go out and find number five. Don't try to make things up. If it happened, you know, you should find out. All right. Now, what they found, though, in this Q source, was that the sources there said nothing about Jesus as Messiah, nothing about Jesus as the Christ, nothing about Jesus as the Anointed One, the Redeemer who had atoned for humankind's sins by his crucifixion, or as the Son of God who rose from the dead. In other words, the Q source had information only about the earthly ministry of Jesus in the first three Gospels, going around healing, teaching, all these things. Nothing about what we call the post Easter Jesus, okay? Because when you stop to think of it, there are some enormous leaps you have to make when you look at the story. And especially, have you ever thought of this, and I don't say this critically at all, how vague we are about the ascension of Jesus, you know, I mean, all these other things are very clear and precise and all right. And it's sort of, maybe he went up, maybe he went somewhere else. He just sort of, maybe who knows where he went. That would indicate they really don't know. On these things. So there are people, what I'm trying to say, who do these things like the Jesus Seminar and the Q Source, all the rest, who really are sincere, not trying to debunk or demythologize or anything like that, but they're trying to figure out, you know, really what happened. Because if you stop to think, the post-Easter Jesus is a whole different person than the one that we have in the first, you know, the one, this weird one that I'm talking about before, about the other, about the dead, bury the dead. And suddenly, there is the other one who, okay, forward. Okay. So what they have concluded is that there were a group of what they call radical wandering sages who went around asking people, did you know Jesus? Did you hear Jesus? What did he say? They wrote these things down. And they have come up with sort of a different kind of Jesus. There's all these different kinds of Jesus. They say, here, this is cute. Here is a Jesus for the third millennium. A Jesus with very little supernatural baggage, but with great respect for cultural diversity. That sounds like, you know, what a lot of people, maybe with PC people, would like to think about Jesus. Wouldn't it be great if Jesus, you know, were just the way we wanted him to be? And they're saying, lo and behold, we've got him. We've got him in this document called Q. Okay. And they said there was a clear message that what Jesus really wanted was to preach the life of what we call possessionlessness. Remember the rich young ruler, sell all you have, give to the poor, and full acceptance of all people, no matter how marginal or disreputable. And so therefore, they have written these down and are working on this particular document, and the battle, is sort of set now. My own feeling is this, that we won't really know this, the end of this, until we see if there really is a document. Because, we can't cope with the Dead Sea Scrolls. These were incredibly rich findings because, and what was interesting with the Dead Sea Scrolls was that they substantiated the translations that came with it. There weren't any major changes between these original documents that they found. Remember these Bedouins or these shepherds found these in the caves way out there, what we call, significant differences at all. So, we shall see. But I like, my conclusion here would be to do something like this. I'd like to have a reply. This is a Professor Franz Joseph von Beek at Loyola University in Chicago. And he says this about what I'm talking about here. He said, we have the Gospel of John. And we all agree, everybody agrees that John is different. John is canonical. This has been accepted for like 1800 years in the church. John is canonical on this. And faith means faith in Christ alive, not just in a historical figure. I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but I'll go through what Van Beek says on this. He said, faith is faith in Christ alive, not just faith in a historical figure. There may well have been all these things that when they say about Jesus, he may well have been the sort of person, but you come back with 1 Corinthians 15, if Christ be not raised from the dead, our faith is in vain. That is a sort of a normative kind of statement that was being made. Okay. And he says it's Christ's resurrection. You see, this is the point. Christ's resurrection is the origin of Christian worship and prayer. Christ's resurrection, that's the origin of the church. If there weren't for the resurrection, Jesus would be one more, itinerant, wandering radical who had some interesting ideas and then came and went, like John the Baptist. In fact, some people think that Jesus was trying to carry off John the Baptist mission. And so on. Okay. The real Jesus is the resurrected Jesus who is experienced, encountered, and addressed in worship. And to use his words, and in whose name and by whose spirit powerful works are performed. Christians, this is the point. Christians direct their faith not to the historical figure of Jesus, but to the living Jesus who is alive here and now. That's the difference. There may well have been all these things that the Jesus seminar say, that the Q people say, but that's not the source or the object really of our faith. Our faith is in the resurrected Jesus. That has to make all the difference in the world. And then I've got more things that he said here. So what do you think? Any comments, questions? Why, go back to my first question, what's so attractive about this fellow, you think? Besides other than, the resurrection thing, why is there sort of an ongoing appeal that attracts all sorts of different people? People have written, just the great American novelist Norman Mailer, there's a good example, has just written another book. His latest book is sort of a reworking of the Gospels. And he's an agnostic Jew, but he's attracted to Jesus.
And could it be that he was one who claimed divinity? Yes. I and the Father are one, and I come from the Father. Only I know the Father.
Pretty big step. That's a pretty strong statement. For a carpenter's son.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that you find that appealing or interesting?
Well, yes.
Yeah. Because
nobody else claims that.
No, that's true.
And I think that, the understanding I have, that here was a person that would make what we would call radical statements, but his life and his actions, as I read them, prove what he said. He not only spoke the faith, so to speak, but he lived it.
The theology of the cross.
Theology of the cross.
Yeah, that's good Protestant, Reformation Protestant teaching, the theology of the cross. If it weren't for the cross, right. And yeah, I think so.
We live in an age where everything has to be explained. We have to know why, how, and everything. So this is, I think it's a normal process of the Jesus group and all of this. And I think if we had Jesus on a videotape, or he had written a book, I wouldn't promote faith any more than what we have. Yeah, some of the stuff bothers me, but I managed to get rid of it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, my faith is not only in what I read in the New Testament. It's from experience. It's from a conversion. It's from what's happened in my life that I can look back and see God working and things like that. And I guess that's the process of faith.
Yeah. I know myself, some of you maybe heard me say this, I was out in the desert looking for, that's a long story, but I was going to do an elder hospital down at the Lutheran Retreat Center, just north of Phoenix, a town called Carefree. And I needed some cough medicine, and I knew where there was a grocery store, and I set out to get some cough medicine, and in the dark, that's important. And I stepped off in an embankment. I didn't know the embankment was there, obviously, and the embankment was this high. And I went down, and this broke, this, my left arm went out to break it, and I found myself there, you know, and I heard the coyotes, and I could have landed on my head, I could have landed on my spine, all the rest of these things. And I, you know, I remembered a line from a Ronald Reagan movie, you know, about twiddling his toes to see if it was, toes were still working and my toes still worked. So then I touched my hand and my wrist, and I could feel the bones moving in the wrist. That got my attention. And then this is the part, I somehow, I don't know to this day how, I got back to the retreat center, about 300 yards away. And I still to this day don't know how it was. And somebody from our church said, he said, really, the Lord wasn't done with you yet. And that's the only way I can explain it. I cannot, you know, I consider myself sort of a hard-boiled intellectual, and I have to go through all these things. And this one, I don't know if, you know, yours, but that just rang true to me, that there was something going on here that I can't, you know, understand. Very, that there are ways of knowing that aren't the ways just of this world. That's what I'm trying to say. And as you say, everything has to be explained.
Yeah.
Yeah. And some people can't make the leap of faith. And I think, I like the passage, we do walk by faith and not by sight. And I really, that's hard for a lot of people to, you know, to understand. And I've got a good friend who's a very prominent biochemist, and everything that's true is something that can be proved and attested to. And that's it. And we argue, and I argue with him. He lives in Seattle now. He retired from Northfield and St. Olaf and moved to Seattle. We had the same old arguments again 2 weeks ago, and that was fine. We enjoy it. I learned from him. I learned from Stu very much, and I stay with him. But that's where we're at, and that's very difficult for a lot of people to accept. And I believe in faith.
I guess if you can prove something, you really don't need faith.
Yeah. Yes. And who's to say that you know, God reveals everything to everybody exactly the same way? We're arguing that now and some other things. Does this make any sense, what I'm trying to say? I'd like your evaluation. Was it clear what I was trying to say? Mm-hmm. We have what we could call a critique here. If I were to hand out a sheet for critiques and you were to number me, I don't want to do this, but 1 to 5, would it be fairly clear? Would I get at least a 3 for what I'm trying to get here? That's all I want. Mm-hmm. A 3. Don't send me a 1. I mean, nothing else to joke.
Well, let me ask you this. Sure. Some of the things you said, you know, you could get responses. People could jump up and leave or whatever,
yeah,
including the AD thing. I mean,
yes.
As a Christian, I think I can say AD, and
sure,
they can say what they want to, and I guess I'm going to hold that till,
right,
well, forever.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess I took that stand a few years ago as I taught also in faculty rooms where, you know, actually condemned for being Christian. But, you know, sometimes you have to draw lines.
Yeah.
And you're saying, well, that's okay. And at times, I guess some of those things aren't okay to me, that as a Christian, I'm just going to take my stand.
Okay, because we live in an age where, you know, the standard response to something like that is, whatever, you know, mm-hmm, or no problem, you know, because we're afraid of controversy. Yeah.
It's kind of like even the Lord's Prayer, the old version of the new version, where, like in the Sailor, it seems like most Lutheran churches gave up on the new version and have gone back.
Yeah.
To trespasses and so forth, because people sort of pushed. You know, I know, and that's,
okay,
again, stuff. But it's kind of interesting.
I think temptation, lead us not into temptation, is better than save us from the time of trial. But I think sins is better than trespasses.
Yeah,
because trespassing to me is when a farmer puts up a no trespassing sign.
That's my overall point, anyway, as you do this, I don't know if you need a little reflection time or getting a little bit more from people as you go along on the controversy type things.
And then another thing, too, if you're a teacher, you know, you have to know your audience and what what they know. And otherwise, it's just like talking to the wind. Mm-hmm. And so that comes, that's exactly what the kind of feedback that I appreciate. But
I guess the Bethlehem Nazareth thing, too, is that is speculation in itself, too, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's still speculation.
But it is, your faith doesn't depend on it. That's
what I'm trying to say.
And that there are some areas, and I like what Reverend Charles says, that what you have going for the older tradition, we have the power of the Holy Spirit to lead us, which the historic Jesus Seminar people don't have. And you have to trust that the Holy Spirit is going to lead us into the truth, and will lead us in these things. And I think that's the important point to ask for that.
Yeah, and a lot of good old songs will be wrong too, you know.
And that's too bad, because I like the old songs. I've got a whole long thing on that. I know sometimes you have to change. Some of the contemporary stuff is good. John Ilvesacker writes some wonderful stuff. Marty Hogan, the things we have here are great. And there's this one, Spirit of Restlessness. It's a wonderful hymn, about 20 years old. But I still like O Day Full of Grace. I've heard the same old choir sing that ever since my mother could carry me, I think, because my home town was only 25 miles from Northfield, and so my brother was in the choir. I like the old hymns.
Before you started explaining all of this stuff, the thought that came to my mind that it didn't make a whole lot of difference to me.
Okay.
I mean, not disrespectfully, but what I mean was that it didn't make a whole lot of difference. And it was kind of like, my mind is made up, don't confuse me with the facts.
Then you have to say, what happens to people who have the faith and might even begin to lose it or slip because of some of the stuff that's going on here? That's the point, for not only for pastors, but for your good friends. My mother always liked, her hair setter was the village agnostic. His name was Clarence Battle. And Clarence liked to sort of make fun of some of the inconsistencies and shortcomings that he found there. We could always tell when mother had her hair, not only because of the change there, but she was still mad at Clarence. And we didn't get much of a dinner that night. And then she came up, and with your point, and she came up, I know in whom I have believed.
Yeah.
And that's the answer, right? I know in whom I have believed. Right? And it's not a book, and it's not a method of historical method, it's a person. And that's the whole thing, right? And I like that one. But
there's also the fact that I think that Jesus, in a sense, speaks to the human condition.
Yeah.
Is not dated. The human condition is ongoing and will be the same as long as we're human, as long as we're alive. And that has some merit, too.
Oh, I have no question. And Paul, too, for that matter.
It speaks
to me, always the good that I would, I do not, and the evil that I would not. That's one of the most profound things,
Yeah.
Or just finish with this one, because I never like to lead people and take over them. To me, one of the most profound stories of all in literature is the woman of the story of Jesus and the woman at the well. This is one of the most profound, remarkable insights, into another person. And that it's good, among other things, it's good psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't have to have a PhD in clinical psychology, to understand that this was just exactly the right thing for him to have said. And those things ring true all the way through. Right?
Yeah.